WZBU New Holstein Appleton, the Fox Valley's real news and great conversation, a civic media station.
ABC News, I'm Brian Clark. President Trump's in Scotland, but he's not been able to escape questions about Jeffrey Epstein and Epstein's longtime companion, Ghislaine Maxwell. Maxwell, serving 20 years in prison, met Thursday and Friday with Deputy Attorney General Todd Blanche.
Sources tell ABC News Maxwell requested the meeting and was granted a limited form of immunity so she could answer questions without fear her responses could later be used against her.
She was asked maybe about 100 different people. She answered questions about everybody. And she didn't hold anything back.
That's ABC's Eric Kotursky speaking with Maxwell's lawyer. The Attorney General Pam Bondi reportedly told the president in May his name was in Epstein's files. He's denied that. It does not indicate any wrongdoing. New humanitarian worries in Gaza, where 25 people were killed, according to Palestinian authorities, many of whom were waiting for aid as the UN warns of starvation. This is ABC News. California Governor Gavin Newsom says his state could consider redrawing its congressional maps to help Democrats in the House of Representatives. He met with Texas state legislators to discuss Republican attempts to do the same in Texas.
They're not screwing around. We cannot afford to screw around either. We have got to fight fire with fire.
The governor called the plan a five-alarm fire for democracy in the United States. A number of NFL figures are in trouble over their handling of Super Bowl tickets, as ABC's Alex Perchet explains.
An NFL source tells ABC News that the league is fining roughly 100 players and about two dozen club employees for allegedly reselling Super Bowl tickets for a profit. The league source says the alleged violations happened during Super Bowl 59 this past year, saying an investigation uncovered that players, coaches, and employees participated, which broke a long-established league policy.
I'm Brian Clark, ABC News.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba,
the founder of Wonderfully Wisconsin. He's been on the show before, but tonight he's here to make the popcorn pick of the week. Mr. Paul Vandenplas,
the Peanut Butter Falcon.
Oh my God, I love when people pick a movie I know nothing about.
A campy comedy buddy story, really just a heartwarming message.
Paul picked a movie that I've never heard of that gets excellent critic and audience reviews. Very well done, Mr. Wonderfully Wisconsin.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba, weeknights from 6 till 8 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app. Matt and Air on Air.
Corrine Hendrickson, you mentioned a conversation with Ron Johnson, Corrine, about the need for child care in Wisconsin. How did that go?
I said, why don't you think we should fund? And he goes, I think an elegant solution, it would be for moms like you to stay home so the other moms can go to work. And I said, well, and I shouldn't get paid for that? And he just kind of stared at us. And I said, that tells me all I need to know.
Matt and Air on Air, weekday mornings 9 to 11 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. Local news, weather, and sports on air and streaming on the Civic Media app. This is the Civic Media Radio Network.
For Civic Media News, I'm Sholly Pittman. A new report from AARP says one in five people in Wisconsin are unpaid caregivers. Judith Ruiz Branch of the Wisconsin News Connection has more.
Roughly 580,000 Wisconsinites and 63 million Americans provide ongoing care to adults or children with medical conditions or disabilities, and a new report says that's a 45% increase since 2015. Experts call the jump paired with a lack of resources an escalating national crisis. The new AARP report shows the average caregiver spends 27 hours per week on caregiving tasks. AARP's CEO Maisha Minter-Jordan notes that caregiving can impact a person's finances as well as their physical and mental health.
We need systems that see caregivers, value them, and support them because they are not just helping families, they are holding up our entire healthcare system.
Minter-Jordan says AARP is advocating for a national paid family and medical leave policy, workplace protections for caregivers, federal tax credits, and access to respite care, training, and support services. The report shows just 11% of caregivers have been trained for basic tasks, and yet National Alliance for Caregiving CEO Jason Resendez says he's seeing unprecedented complexity in caregiving.
Beyond daily care, over half of family caregivers, that's more than 30 million Americans, are performing complex medical and nursing tasks that once primarily took place in clinics and hospitals.
He says just over 1 in 5 caretakers who administer injections, manage catheters, and use other medical equipment have received training to do so. Some resources for caregivers can be found online at aarp.org/caregiving. For Wisconsin News Connection, I'm Judith Ruiz Branch. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
As Wisconsin has summer weekends being spent on the lake, this is the Civic Media Radio Network.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. For today, mostly sunny and highs in the mid-80s. Tonight, mostly clear, upper 60s. Sunny, hot, and humid for Sunday. Highs in the low 90s. The heat index will push near 100. Sunday night, chance of showers and thunderstorms in low 70s.
Right now, it's 70.
Todd Albaugh.
Hey, everybody. Join us next time. We'll take a look back at the Wisconsin News headlines for the weekend, who may be in the running for governor next, and previewing our Tuesday show with Joe Thomas. Join us.
The Todd Albaugh Show, weekdays 2 to 4.
This is 98.3 and 96.5 WISS, home of Matt and Air on Air.
Welcome to Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel. Civic Media's weekly review and discussion of some of the most significant news stories in the areas of law, government, courts, and the aspiration for justice. And now, here's your host, Jim Santel.
This is Amicus Law Review. My name is Jim Santel. Welcome to this, the second hour of our weekend broadcast, all things related to justice and government and the rule of law. Necessarily in this, the second hour of our broadcast, talking about the United States Supreme Court, some things that it has done just this past week. An awful lot of you saying, wait, I thought they were done issuing those major opinions, those 67 cases, rulings of its merits docket in this 2024-2025 term. And indeed, they are done. We will talk more about the implications of those as we have done in the past. They continue to invoke, however, their emergency docket processes. This is the so-called shadow docket about which we have spoken an awful lot in the past. We're going to spend some time talking again about the reasons why this is problematic, the reasons why this is such a change in our recent historical practice with respect to the receipt, the filing, the action on administrative requests for immediate action by a Supreme Court. And we'll begin with a little bit of history of recent times. And then, as you may recall well, as the Supreme Court has issued various orders on about 40, count them, 40 different cases, different kinds of things of recent months. Among those, the decisions that it has made permitting the president to remove some leaders, some commissioners of major entities like the Merit Systems Protection Board. That's the commission that reviews the hiring, the firing of federal employees when they feel aggrieved by decisions, employment decisions made, and also by the National Labor Relations Board. In recent cases, the Supreme Court, upon the application of the government, of the administration, of the Inspector General, being asked immediately to entertain overturning the lower court decisions that have preserved the jobs, the positions of those commissioners on the Merit Systems Protection Board, the National Labor Relations Board, even as the litigation as to them goes on in those lower courts. And in those two cases, as in many, many others, the Supreme Court has said, sure, go ahead. You can remove those commissioners. And they're doing that without providing explanation, without description, without the kinds of explanations and descriptions that we see in all of those other merits decisions that we've talked about, the 67 other cases. And indeed, it's happened again just this past week in two different areas, two very different cases, two very different results, both, however, invoking once again the emergency docket, both raising the issue of why. Why are we doing these things, even if you agree or disagree with the ultimate decision, not getting a result? just this past week, the Supreme Court, in one of its two latest invocations of the emergency docket, has allowed the president to fire, to terminate the positions of three members of the Consumer Product Safety Commission, CPSC, the Consumer Product Safety Commission. That's a five-member group that monitors things like household goods, things in your kitchen, your bathrooms, in your garages, electronics, all sorts of appliances, things your children play with, their cribs, their toys, all kinds of things. You know them well. You encounter them indirectly every time you walk into an appliance store, an electronics store, a toy store, virtually any commercial area where you buy things in a consumer capacity. The court's brief order, again, as it is in all of these cases, unsigned. That's typical. We don't know exactly who said what, but we do know in this case, as always, that there are three other members of the Supreme Court, not among the six, who said, yes, go ahead and fire these commissioners. Three of them dissenting. We know who they are. They're Elena Kagan, Ketanji Brown Jackson, and Sonia Sotomayor. The order cited as its reasoning, that is the majority order, a previous decision involving the leaders of these two other independent agencies. That's why these cases involving the Merit Systems Protection Board and the National Labor Relations Board, that they are apparently now being viewed as precedent, even though there's no description of the reason why the commissioners of those boards were fired. Supreme Court says, well, we've done that before, we're going to do it again. And without justifying the terminations, without in any way explaining why it is the president's decision to terminate these particular people is lawful, constitutional, rightful under the law, consistent with what the Congress had done when it created this, yes, independent agency. The president, as an aside, not the head, not the chief of the Consumer Product Safety Commission. No authority to oversee what they do. That's the congressional mandate. No explanation from our Supreme Court about why it is then he has the power to terminate the positions of these commissioners. We suspect that these commissioners got the attention of the president by virtue of the fact, and targeted by our president, by the fact that they had cast some votes to stop the importation recently of some poorly made lithium-ion batteries. That's the kind of thing we would like the Consumer Product Safety Commission to do. Why? Because if they, as scientists and people who know what they're talking about, make the decision that some products coming into our nation arguably being sold on the shelves of our commercial places, if they make those decisions, we want them to be enforced. They said we don't want these particular lithium-ion batteries in our consumer ambit because they pose a safety risk to Americans. And oh, by the way, these three commissioners, their names are Mary Boyle, Richard Trumka, and Alexander Hone Sarek. All three of them were also objecting to some recent staffing cuts, saying that we can't do our jobs well. We can't protect the American public, its consumer rights, if in fact we don't have enough employees to investigate, to determine whether or not products and goods in with our children, with our adults, whether they are properly on the shelves of American stores. And so they complained. And they issued this vote with respect to batteries, attracting the attention of our president, who has fired them. And done so illegally, like the firings of those from the other commissions, the Merit Systems Protection Board, the National Labor Relations Board. Now we add to the list the Consumer Product Safety Commission. These are illegal. They are illegal. The Congress has established these entities as independent. They are not subject to review by the president. That's the whole purpose behind it. They can be removed if, in fact, there is good cause to do so based upon some malfeasance, some nonfeasance, some misfeasance that can be identified. And even then, there is a process for doing that. You don't fire commissioners like this because you don't like their decisions. That's what they've been charged to do. You don't fire them because they're exercising their First Amendment rights, which we'd also expect them to do, to talk about the mechanisms by which they can and cannot do their jobs with reduced staffing. They are gone. And again, the underlying litigation challenging these firings, that continues. But for practical purposes, it means that they are gone. And even as the lower court says, the Supreme Court has said, they can continue to entertain the arguments about the constitutionality and legality of all this. But why then, Supreme Court? Why then an emergency application to go in? Why is it so urgent to fire these people right now? They've been in place for a long period of time. Why do we need to fire them on this emergency application, urgent docket? Because what? The interests of justice compel that if they stay in their offices 1 hour longer, a day longer, a week longer, somehow something horrific will happen. It's just the opposite. And something horrific now happens when these commissions, these boards do not have the staff, the professional staff, the executive staff at the top to do their jobs. Another invocation of the emergency docket, the shadow docket, because we're not getting explanations about why the Supreme Court is doing these things. And we'll get back to that after we talk about the other application of the emergency docket just this past week. An entirely different set of facts. This one has to do with the Voting Rights Act, and it comes out of the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals, but also out of Louisiana. You may recall we talked about this briefly in our exposition of some of the major cases on the merits docket coming out of the Supreme Court just this past term. There was this case coming out of Louisiana. And among all the 67 cases, this is the one where the Supreme Court curiously had us scratching our heads. Oddly, they said, you know what? We're not doing anything with that one right now. We're going to reschedule this case for oral argument, maybe some more discussion. We're going to redefine the questions that we're going to be asking the attorneys in this case. Comes out of Louisiana on, yes, once again, a gerrymandering challenge to line drawing there of districts in Louisiana. It has to do with the Voting Rights Act and Section 2. That's the basic protection against discrimination based upon color and language under this major civil rights legislation in the 1960s. That case not resolved. The Supreme Court says, you know what? We're not going to address that right now. Bring that back in the next term. And there's an awful lot of thought that maybe, just maybe, the reason why they did not resolve that case is because there's internal fighting, as there often is, about the very legitimacy of the Voting Rights Act itself. Maybe there's some discussion about how broadly we should be going in terms of addressing this Louisiana case in connection with the entire legitimacy, the constitutionality of the Voting Rights Act itself. And I say all that as prelude, as an anticipation of what comes next. And that is what the Supreme Court did just this past week in a case that might curiously be related to the Louisiana case and the odd disposition of a number of weeks ago. Supreme Court, just this past Thursday, preserving on its emergency urgent docket, it says it's going to preserve the Voting Rights Act and does it on the emergency docket, again, without any explanation. We'll get back to that. Preserving the status quo of the Voting Rights Act for the entire nation, including the states. They're basically the Midwestern states just to the west of us, the Eighth Circuit states, including North Dakota, South Dakota, Nebraska, Minnesota, on down to Arkansas, just to our immediate west here, seven states there altogether. Preserving the status quo in guaranteeing voters, at least for now, the right to sue, to bring litigation, to bring a lawsuit, to enforce rights under Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act of 1965. Now, I might say, well, gee, what is this all about? I thought we could sue under the Voting Rights Act. And yes, indeed, that has been the law of the land ever since the Voting Rights Act was signed by Lyndon Johnson, passed by the United States Congress a long, long time ago in the mid-1960s. At issue in the North Dakota case is Section 2. That's the basic core case, the core provision of the Voting Rights Act, which makes race-based discrimination illegal. Signed again into law by President Lyndon Johnson, prohibiting discriminatory practices like literacy tests and poll taxes, other things like that that would disenfranchise voters of color in America. When we come back, I'll tell you what exactly this Eighth Circuit case is all about and what it is that the Supreme Court did on its emergency docket, at least for now, to preserve the Voting Rights Act in America. All that as our broadcast continues.
Tom Hartman here. You're listening to WISS.
Experience Northern Wisconsin this season and book your vacation at Lena's Northern Pines Resort on beautiful Butternut Lake in Butternut, Wisconsin. This quaint resort has it all. A full-service resort and restaurant, open year-round for all your seasons, from ATVing to snowmobiling, grouse hunting, deer hunting, and even ice fishing. Or just come to relax with the whole family. And there's also an event space for that perfect occasion that you might be celebrating. Butternut Lake is a 1,000-plus acre Class A musky lake, along with walleye, crappie, perch, and panfish that the kids love to catch. It's perfect for escaping the hustle and bustle of the city. Check your next adventure out today. Go to northernpines.net, www.northernpines.net.
Who's ready to compete? With Chalk. It's Amanda with another new Wisco 411 for you, brought to you by Area 509 in Appleton. And you got to get those creative juices flowing and register for the 12th annual Oshkosh Chalk Walk. Artists will create chalk artwork on the sidewalk around the Opera House Square throughout the day, and visitors are encouraged to check it out, and you get to vote for the winners. Plus, there's going to be food, activities, music, and more. But if it rains, the new date is August 9th. You got to check this out. Head to WISS.FM and click events.
There's no better place to catch Brewers baseball than right here. Every pitch, every hit, every home run.
And a fly ball to right center. Malloy is back, and this one is good again for Hoskins.
Brewers baseball on WISS is brought to you by Addison Jones Realty, Zeroni's Macaroni Pizza Pub, Green Thumb Organics, and Berkshire Hathaway Water City Realty. Catch Brewers baseball all season long on WISS.
Teachers are diverse, skilled leaders, innovating to prepare students for our fast-changing world. Teaching shapes lives. Are you ready? Explore teaching at teach.org, supported by the U.S. Department of Education and 1 million teachers of color.
Connecting audiences, powering brands. This is Civic Media. Learn more at civicmedia.us/advertise.
This is Amicus Solara View. Thank you once again for spending a portion of your weekend with me and my producer, Max, talking about, as we often do, seemingly every broadcast, about the United States Supreme Court. We do that because it is important to know about. It's important to understand what it is they're doing and what they're not doing when it comes to this emergency docket. We know that the Supreme Court, again, just this past week, permitted the president to terminate the status, the employment of some commissioners of the Consumer Product Safety Commission. That being done without any explanation, no justification, no explanation for why it is the president, with no authority to do that, nonetheless can go ahead and do just that. We've got this other case coming out of the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals, and it also is the subject of disposition, not without dissent in the Supreme Court, by the Supreme Court pursuant to its emergency docket. The North Dakota case began in 2021. This is the one in the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals. The Republican-dominated state legislature in that particular state implemented a revised redistricting plan. We have seen this in legislatures virtually in every state of the nation. It was challenged by two Native American Indian tribes, and they contended that by virtue of the lines that were drawn, the redistricting map diluted Native American voting strength and violated, therefore, Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, which prohibits discrimination in voting and elective processes based upon race. The tribe said in particular the result of the redistricting was that for the first time in 35 years in North Dakota, no Native American candidates were serving in the North Dakota Senate. Now, that's where it just begins. That's where the litigation begins. Federal District Court initially sides with the tribes. It blocks the enforcement of the map and sets a deadline for the legislature to come back with a better map. When that deadline is passed, the district court requires the state to implement a new map endorsed by the Native American tribes that corrects the problem. And that results in the election of one Native American state senator and two members of the state House of Representatives. All of that gets appealed to the appellate court there. And they argue not only that the underlying decision by the district court is wrong, but also interesting. And here's the rub, that the individuals, the Native American tribes in particular, who have standing, don't have the right to sue the government in the first place, don't have the right to sue over alleged violations of the Voting Rights Act. The Eighth Circuit, believe it or not, agrees with that. And what's this all about? Well, it's been out there for a while against one of these fringe theories that it finds no support in the legislative history of the Voting Rights Act way back in 1965, in the history of the enforcement of the Voting Rights Act. But it basically says that only the United States government, only the Attorney General, the Civil Rights Division of the Department of Justice, only the government can sue for remedies under Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. Private parties cannot do it. Private entities, individuals out of luck, cannot go into court. And that theory, although it's been out there, has got no support. Other courts have addressed this and summarily dismissed it because they have said that, no, the language of the Voting Rights Act clearly contemplates private causes of action. Individuals who are not the government can sue. They have done it. It is significant to note that the great majority of cases brought under the Voting Rights Act are done by private parties, individuals, and entities. Absent their involvement, absent their participation, their work in this area, there would not be a jurisprudence under the Voting Rights Act. And so this has been roundly dismissed until recently when it gets to the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals. The Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals agrees with the government there in North Dakota, and citing its own previous ruling in 2023, says that the Native American tribes are not empowered by the statute, do not have the authority under the Voting Rights Act to sue. Only the government can do that. They're not here in this case. Therefore, the case cannot go ahead. No right to vindicate the basic provisions of Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. The tribes then go to the Supreme Court and ask them to block this standalone, this separate decision from the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals for the first time at an appellate level, says you've got no right to sue under the Voting Rights Act. Get rid of this. Tell the Eighth Circuit, the tribes say, tell the Eighth Circuit to stand down. Don't do this. They contend that if the court doesn't intervene, the state could kick out of office those duly elected tribe members who are there by virtue of a map that came out of the very litigation that produced this kind of result. And so the results are important practically, not only in that state, North Dakota, but also throughout the Eighth Circuit and arguably throughout the country. Because if this notion, this doctrine says that only individuals who are in the Department of Justice, only lawyers who are commissioned by the Department of Justice can sue, nobody else can sue, that brings a close to this litigation and, frankly, the great majority of the other pieces of litigation around the country that enforce voting rights in America. So what does the Supreme Court do this past week? Once again, here it invokes its emergency docket. Doesn't tell us again why it does that, but a majority of the Supreme Court, we know it's 6-3. It's not the normal consortium, if you will, that we anticipate here. The Supreme Court does say it intervenes in this case and says, at least temporarily, we're going to tell the Eighth Circuit to stand down. Temporarily, the rights of individual voters to bring these vote dilution actions are enforced. They're going to remain in place. The law, which has been in this nation's courts and in our country ever since 1965, remains in place. The Supreme Court does that this past week, effectively overturning for now what the Eighth Circuit has done, but does it on its emergency docket. And in this case, again, you're maybe saying, well, gee, that's a good result. It is a good result for those of us, I'd like to think all of us of any party, any persuasion, who are committed to voting rights in America and committed to the fundamental focuses of the Voting Rights Act. When we come back, we'll tell you about the implications of that. And then we're going to take some callers who are part of our discussion here on Amicus, a Law Review.
This is 98.3 and 96.5 WISS, home of Matt and Air on Air.
ABC News, I'm Brian Clark. President Trump's in Scotland, but he's not been able to escape questions about Jeffrey Epstein and Epstein's longtime companion, Ghislaine Maxwell. Maxwell, serving 20 years in prison, met Thursday and Friday with Deputy Attorney General Todd Blanche.
Sources tell ABC News Maxwell requested the meeting and was granted a limited form of immunity so she could answer questions without fear her responses could later be used against her.
She was asked maybe about 100 different people. She answered questions about everybody. And she didn't hold anything back.
That's ABC's Eric Kotursky speaking with Maxwell's lawyer. The Attorney General Pam Bondi reportedly told the president in May his name was in Epstein's files. He's denied that. It does not indicate any wrongdoing. New humanitarian worries in Gaza, where 25 people were killed, according to Palestinian authorities, many of whom were waiting for aid as the UN warns of starvation. This is ABC News.
As Wisconsin has summer weekends being spent on the lake, this is the Civic Media Radio Network.
The Brewers lose to Miami. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. Baseball, the Brewers with a 5-1 loss to the Marlins. Miami has now won 7 of the last 10 games. Brewers manager Pat Murphy.
That team over there is hot. They're playing good, and they're coming of age. And it's reflective in their last 10 games and how some of those players are coming into their own. And we didn't do enough.
NFL training camp continues in Green Bay. The players with a day off, they resume practice tomorrow morning at 10:30. Mark Murphy held his final press conference after 17 years as the team president and CEO.
You know, it's a little bittersweet. I mean, obviously, I'm very appreciative. You know, I feel honored, you know, that the fans have been so supportive, you know, of me and the organization. You know, I feel so grateful to Bob Harlan. You know, he and I overlapped for a number of months, but more importantly, you know, he left the organization and great place, and hopefully I've done the same.
That's the Packers' Mark Murphy with Sports on Mike Clemens.
Connecting audiences, powering brands. This is Civic Media. Learn more at civicmedia.us/advertise.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. For today, mostly sunny and highs in the mid-80s. Tonight, mostly clear, upper 60s. Sunny, hot, and humid for Sunday. Highs in the low 90s. The heat index will push near 100. Sunday night, chance of showers and thunderstorms in low 70s.
It's 73 at our studios.
I'm Dan Schaefer. Let's recombobulate. After weeks of speculation, Governor Tony Evers has finally made his decision. He is not running for a third term. Evers has had an accomplished career as a dedicated public servant for 5 decades and has been a terrific governor for the state of Wisconsin these last 6+ years. And we should be grateful for his time in office. It's been a job well done. But all things must pass. In making this decision to step aside and not seek another term, Tony Evers is doing what he has done time and time again. He's doing the right thing. And perhaps in making this decision, Governor Evers can be the one to turn the tide on the Democratic Party's unwillingness to pass the torch to the next generation. In his own unassuming way, the mild-mannered former science teacher who became Wisconsin's governor can be an example to Democrats across the nation. Because we know what happens in Wisconsin politics often has ramifications that reach well beyond the state's borders.
Find all of Dan's work at the Recombobulation Area. Matt and Air on Air.
Corrine Hendrickson, you mentioned a conversation with Ron Johnson, Corrine, about the need for childcare in Wisconsin. How did that go?
I said, why don't you think we should fund? And he goes, I think an elegant solution, it would be for moms like you to stay home so the other moms can go to work. And I said, well, and I shouldn't get paid for that? And he just kind of stared at us. And I said, that tells me all I need to know.
Matt and Air on Air, weekday mornings 9 to 11 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
Doctors Without Borders is delivering life-saving medical care where it's needed most in communities around the world. From bandaging war-wounded patients in Sudan to providing clean drinking water in Haiti, we're in more than 70 countries worldwide, bringing patients from sick to recovering, from emergency to aid, from crisis to care. This life-saving care is made possible by a global movement of supporters like you. Thank you.
Jane Matinair and Greg Bach.
Coming up on the show, Civic Media News Director Sholly Pittman will be joining us to break down all of the news that happened over the weekend. Nothing will happen. Join us.
Matinair on Air, weekday mornings 9 to 11.
This is Amicus Law Review. My name is Jim Santel. Thank you for once again joining me this weekend. We are talking, as we necessarily have to do, about the United States Supreme Court and its continuing invocation of this emergency docket application. We know that in this term alone, the government has gone to the Supreme Court on 20 different occasions, virtually all of those granted by the Supreme Court in matters of great import. We'll get back to that. Just this past week, once again, granting the government the capacity to fire members, commissioners of the Consumer Product Safety Commission, and then going out to the Eighth Circuit and saying, you know what? In the decision that the Eighth Circuit has made that prohibited people, including Native American Indian tribes, from going ahead to challenge the decisions, the voting related decisions there in North Dakota, that the Eighth Circuit is wrong and cannot limit the litigation going ahead, preserving the representation of the Native American population there in North Dakota in the Assembly and the Senate. A fascinating result, which many of us, I would say all of us, should embrace. But once again, underscoring, because there's no reason for it, it would be great. It would be interesting. It would be appropriate for all of us to know the reasons why six of them said that. Is it simply because they view the law being as it should be, as it has been since 1965, and the Eighth Circuit is an outlier and they should be stopped from imposing some other view of the Voting Rights Act? We know that there are three justices of the Supreme Court. Their names are Clarence Thomas and Sam Alito and Neil Gorsuch. Say they would have denied this request of the Native American tribes to suspend, to stop the Eighth Circuit opinion from going ahead. That's interesting, and that's fascinating to know. But we still don't know the reason why even this good result is the product of decision-making and judgment and applications of law and fact there inside the Supreme Court. Another example of the problem we are confronting here, especially concerning because this matter in the Eighth Circuit may in fact come back. And it may in fact be the precursor to not only the Louisiana case, which we talked about, but maybe this Eighth Circuit case as well, in which the Supreme Court may be addressing the constitutionality overall of major provisions of the Voting Rights Act, including the capacity to sue. We don't know. There's a huge amount of mystery behind the Louisiana case. There's now mystery behind the Eighth Circuit case. The law hasn't changed anywhere in America, but it may well. And it would be good to know that. Good to know, even in this interim stage, why it is the Supreme Court is doing what it's doing. That's the problem with the emergency docket. The shadow docket does not permit this process in briefing, argument, other issues presentation in the public domain from going ahead. It frequently involves these major issues of great import, right? We know that the Supreme Court has recently done things like revoking legal protections for about a million immigrants in this country, dismissing thousands of federal employees, barring transgender individuals from the military service, replacing leaders of these independent agencies, many other measures out there, doing major things. They're big ticket items, and we're not getting explanations about those. It also changes our language, does it not? What does urgent mean anymore? What does immediate mean? Why is this? Why do these things have to be done so quickly when, in fact, they've been in place for, in some cases, decades, if not longer? And now, all of a sudden, for reasons that are not explained by the petitioner, the government, why is it that suddenly we need to have these actions undertaken? We understand, coming out of the Eighth Circuit, the reason there, and that's exposed by the petition that doesn't come from the Department of Justice, but comes from the lawyers of the Native American tribes. And they say, yes, indeed, we need to ensure that the Voting Rights Act is enforced. That's the kind of clarity we would like to have when it comes to understanding the urgency and immediacy of all of these other situations. Typically, these decisions produced without any attribution of individuals. We get some numbers. We get some dissenters, as we have in some of these cases, writing 15, 18, 19-page dissents, explaining why, as we saw again this past week, the Supreme Court is doing things that are contrary to what the Congress has commissioned, contrary to by our basic principles about how government works. All of that is what the fuss about the shadow docket is all about. It's the reason why it's so much more than fuss. And yet it continues. We have had 20 applications by the government just this past term. In the previous term of Donald Trump, there were 40 altogether. And just by way of comparison, in the Obama administration, 8 years of Barack Obama, in the previous Bush administration, 8 years of George Bush, 16 years of presidency, there were 8 applications from the government. Four of those were granted. Now, in the first 6 months of this term, we've got 20 applications, the great majority of which are being granted, a concern for every single American out there because of the nature of the problems being discussed and resolved and the way in which they're being done, absent the transparency that we expect of all of our branches of government, including the United States Supreme Court. Appreciate so much our callers, as always, calling in. Appreciate very much David calling in from the West Coast this weekend. Be a part of our discussion, David.
Oh, thanks, Jim. Yeah, I personally think that they're just trying to crush the Magna Carta. What has been 900 years ago that the king was rounded up and forced to say that he was supposed to look out for the people. And it's pretty clear that the corporate state does not want to look out for the people. And so when you're talking about getting rid of the product safety board, just selling cheap crap and forcing us to accept it, that seems like a major part of it. But when you're talking about the voting rights, that whole principle of taxation with representation is torn apart with that. No voting rights, and you got no ability to demand voting rights. I would say that's a big part of it. But when you were talking about the Consumer Product Review Board, I was reminded of, you remember Edgar Allan Poe, one of his most famous stories was called The Mask of the Red Death.
Yes.
And it was about an insane king that was confronted with an epidemic outside the castle walls. And rather than taking care of the people, he decided to slam the door on the people, let the epidemic run riot, and then he was going to have a party. And that party then, Mask of the Red Death, shows up at his party and kills him and the rest of the partygoers. So the whole principle of the Product Safety Board is about that, you know, we've got not only epidemics, but we've got exploding batteries, and he's going to say that it's good to have exploding batteries, let the market forces deal with it later. That's just crazy.
Right. So, and it's doing it, David, could not agree more, doing it in a context that is plainly illegal, right? He doesn't have the authority to do all this. Your point is a very important one, which is, of course, that by doing this, you're also not just doing something inside the Beltway in Washington, you're also compromising our safety and security. That's how important these issues are. That's why the Supreme Court should also tell us about the reason why we're letting him do this. It's the reason why we need to have the reemergence of law. Appreciate the Edgar Allan Poe invocation, David, very much. Appreciate the comment generally. And I also note that Mark has also sent a note into Max and me commenting on the same kinds of things. Trump administration doing some things that are plainly contrary, not just to our Constitution, our laws, but also the very reasons why we have a nation, talking about the Declaration of Independence, the reason why the founders were so troubled and angry and finally overthrew the king and said, no, you can't do these things without authority. Mark, appreciate your comment sent to Max and me as well. David, appreciate so very much your insight and perspective as a part of our discussion, too. And we're also hearing this morning from Jack, calling in from Merrimack. Jack, thank you for being a part of our broadcast.
Thanks for taking my call, Jim. This isn't why I really called, but first of all, this shadow docket stuff's got to stop.
It does.
My personal opinion for the court using it is that there is no real basis for many of these decisions. So the extreme majority doesn't even want to try to twist the laws and Constitution to give an explanation for those decisions. That's, I think, what this is all about. But like I said, that isn't why I called. And it has to do with your first caller as well. I hear the term unelected faceless bureaucrats a lot lately.
Right.
Regarding civil servant regulators in our government. people need to understand these bureaucrats are, yeah, they're not personally elected, but they're authorized by Congress and legislation signed by the president and even in most cases deemed legal by the Supreme Court. And most, if not all, of those currently serving, and that's what they do. They serve the public. They're heavily vetted. They have to, they're almost all experienced.
Most yes.
have to pass serious exams to enter the profession. And I know, because I've taken some of those exams. I've got a master's degree in science. I've been offered a job in that field, and although I didn't accept it. These people are the ones, they look at practical issues, job safety, regulations based on experience, real world data. They look at the science of pharmaceuticals, decide whether the drugs are safe and effective. You know the story on this. The only people who disparagingly call these public servants, and that's what they are, they're servants, faceless bureaucrats, they're people that have an axe to bear, to grind, because one particular regulation or maybe a couple affected them, and it cut down slightly their usually huge profits. The majority of these are decisions are definitely not political decisions.
They're
That's
not.
The whole idea of civil service.
Exactly.
If you want to, if you one last comment, and that is, if you want to see what America would be like without some of these bureaucrats, I suggest that people read a book called The Poison Squad by Deborah Blum. It's about the establishment of the FDA, basically.
The Food and Drug Administration, right? Right, exactly.
Yes.
Another one of those independent commissions designed to keep us safe and secure, Jack, right? Right. What is the name of the book once again?
The Poison Squad.
The Poison Squad.
Deborah Blum. Yeah, Deborah Blum, B-L-U-M. It's a real eye-opener. It takes place around the turn of the last century. I think his first name was Harvey Wiley, and his fight over 20 years to get things like heavy metals that were used to color candy that was sold to kids out of that candy. They were used because those colors are very bright colors, and we've established safety regulations for things like that. It just goes on and on.
Another great example of as you say, Jack, government not intruding in an inappropriate way, intruding in a way in our lives that is positive and good to keep us safe and secure. I love your invocation of the word science and people who know what they're talking about. This is not the deep state. These are not these folks who are unelected bureaucrats who are doing things without any supervision. They're bringing to all of their decisions, as you've said so well, Jack, their insight, their experience, and to the good of all of us. When they depart, when they are not there with sufficient staff, and when they are removed completely, we are all compromised in addition to the compromise in our rule of law system. Jack, so much appreciate your excellent insight this morning, as I do this weekend, this morning, these days, as I do that of David and Mark as well. All of that going to how our government works and the rule of law in America. As we go into our final segment, a couple of more things yet before we break this weekend. One of them has to do with sanctuary cities. And then again, a few comments at the end of our broadcast on Jeffrey Epstein. All that coming up on Amicus.
As Wisconsin is summer weekends being spent on the lake, this is the Civic Media Radio Network.
Looking for food, fun, and live music this summer? Head to Area 509 in Appleton with Caribbean Taste. Every Friday, enjoy a food truck rally from 5 to 8 p.m. with live music from 5:30 to 7:30. Enjoy the Triple S Market, sip, shop, sing, every Sunday from 1 p.m. to 5 p.m. With local artisans, open mic, guest food trucks, a full menu of incredible Caribbean Taste food, charcuterie, mimosas, and more. It's all happening at 1025 North Badger Avenue. Come join the fun!
Woo-hoo! Hear that? That's what having fewer hot flashes and night sweats can sound like. Veozah is the number one prescribed hormone-free treatment FDA approved for moderate to severe vasomotor symptoms, also known as hot flashes and night sweats, due to menopause. Veozah can cause serious side effects, including liver problems. Your doctor will do blood tests before and during treatment.
Stop Veozah and call your doctor if you have symptoms of liver problems, such as feeling more tired than usual, decreased appetite, nausea, vomiting, itching, yellowing of the eyes or skin, pale stool, dark urine, or stomach pain. Don't use Veozah if you have cirrhosis, severe kidney problems, kidney failure, or take CYP1A2 inhibitors. Ask your doctor about Veozah. To learn more, call 1-866-239-1637 or go to Veozah.com. That's Veozah.com.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government by and for the people. We reported last fall that Maine voters approved ballot question 1, limiting contributions to super PACs spending money in state elections. It passed with massive voter support, but like the state's foreign influence ban, was ruled as likely unconstitutional. That's what organizers hoped would happen. The ballot question reads, do you want to set a $5,000 limit for giving to political action committees that spend money independently to support or defeat candidates for office? The act also required super PAC donors to be disclosed. A First Circuit Federal District Court ruled July 15th that both provisions violated free speech protections and pointed to the Citizens United, Buckley v. Valeo, and other past U.S. Supreme Court decisions. Harvard Law professor Lawrence Lessig argues that large contributions to PACs risk quid pro quo corruption of supported candidates, even if a candidate isn't directly speaking with the super PAC. Elon Musk's America PAC and crypto industry super PAC's support of Donald Trump are recent examples. Lessig said in 2023, when the initiative was announced, that it was designed to force the U.S. Supreme Court to answer whether contributions to super PACs can be regulated by states in the same way state candidate contributions are limited. The case will next be appealed in the First Circuit, then could reach the U.S. Supreme Court in late 2026. We have more at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org. I'm Brian Beal.
Local news, weather, and sports on air and streaming on the Civic Media app. This is the Civic Media Radio Network.
This is Amicus a la Review. This is the last segment of our tour, our broadcast. Appreciating so much our callers, those who send in comments as well. We digest them all. You add to the richness and vitality of our discussion. More of that in the future. Always invited here in the broadcast stations of Civic Media. Before we conclude this weekend's broadcast, two other matters on our agenda. One of them related to sanctuary cities. Two things, two different jurisdictions. We note that just this past week, on Thursday, the Justice Department, yes, the Attorney General, has filed a lawsuit against Mayor Eric Adams, claiming that New York City, for which he is still in control, at least as the mayor, he is thwarting, according to the Trump administration, their enforcement immigration laws. Interesting that, once again, the Trump administration apparently at odds with Eric Adams based upon immigration issues. 37-page lawsuit filed in the Federal District Court in Brooklyn. And that says that the city's policies advanced by Eric Adams violate the Supremacy Clause of the Constitution. What does that do? You know that well. It gives federal laws precedence, supremacy, quite literally, over state laws. And the lawsuit names the city council, names the mayor, names the police department, commissioners as defendants. Again, the latest action by the Trump administration against these so-called sanctuary jurisdictions, which, depending upon how you define them, depending upon how particular municipalities may adopt resolutions to support the concept, they limit cooperation between local law enforcement and federal immigration authorities and therefore provide, if you will, sanctuary, with a small s, maybe in quotes as well, for those people who are seeking immigration protection. That filed again just this past week. The administration now again at odds with Eric Adams, briefly in community with him at the time, actually even dismissing the criminal case against him, presumably because they wanted his cooperation with respect to immigration issues. Now, once again, we're back at odds with each other. And it underscores the nature of the reason why you don't dismiss criminal cases for reasons other than the strength of the law and the facts underneath it. Now we've got another lawsuit between Eric Adams, the city of New York, and this administration about immigration. It's back again, and it comes in the wake of another lawsuit that was in the news just this past week. Federal judge in Illinois, the judge there is Lindsay Jenkins, wrote that the Justice Department's lawsuit, in which the Justice Department argued that state and local officials there in Chicago and in other places in that area were violating the Constitution by enforcing, again, the same kind of thing, sanctuary measures that limit cooperation with immigration agents. This particular lawsuit in Illinois begun in the early days of the Trump administration. And once again, it's challenging the immigration policies of what is one of the strongest democratically led jurisdictions in the country. The Illinois lawsuit that has now been dismissed by Judge Jenkins in the federal court named as defendants the governor, the Chicago's mayor, the police superintendent, the Cook County board president, and the sheriff. All of that now dismissed, certainly attracting the attention of the Department of Justice that had litigated that case in the federal district court there in Illinois. The judge finding that this challenge to the Illinois sanctuary measures cannot stand, that the government, that the Department of Justice had failed to show a violation of federal law. Certainly some precedent, admittedly in a different district, certainly some precedent when it comes to that movement forward of the recently filed new lawsuit in the Southern District of New York against Eric Adams. Same basic claims there in New York City. It is a lot. It is complicated. And the beat goes on when it comes to these kinds of sparring between municipal authorities and federal authorities. All of that inside the rule of law. Sparring also, indeed, the catchword of the day in connection with the Jeffrey Epstein matter. I'm going to throw out another word to describe this imbroglio, which is the Jeffrey Epstein matter. It is indeed extremely confusing and complicated and downright embarrassing. And that concept is Occam's razor. Occam's razor. We'll get back to that in just a moment or so. Two legal things, which I seem to do a lot of here in the closing moments of our broadcast. And one of them is in connection with something we predicted, which is the federal district court judge who had before her that request of this administration to release the grand jury documents, the materials here. Her name is Robin Rosenberg. She's in the Southern District of Florida. She said no. That, as we said last week, Rule 6C, the rules and standards for doing this, do not support that. The attorney general, the deputy attorney general, upon their application, they are wrong, she said, and therefore the grand jury documents are not released. As we've said before, the grand jury documents were never, ever the focus of this. Indeed, there's a larger file that plainly is in existence there, all kinds of things that the attorney general could release if she wanted to, business documents, recordings, reports of interviews, that still exists. But we come back to what we do know and what we don't know inside this imbroglio, and it leads to Occam's razor. What is Occam's razor? It is this notion that when it comes to competing theories or competing notions about the world, you go with the simpler explanation of what happened. And indeed, what do we do know about this? We do know a number of things. We do know that a grand jury indicted both Maxwell and Epstein on horrific violations of the law involving human and sex trafficking. We know that she went to trial and that she was convicted. She's spending 20 years in prison. A jury found beyond a reasonable doubt that she is guilty of those offense conduct behaviors. We know that he committed suicide while in the custody of the Bureau of Prisons. We know that that is horrific and that's tragic, just as is the entire prosecution. All of this tragic, including especially for the victims of their offense conduct. We know as well that almost certainly there was not a client list here, but an awful lot of information that could in fact be presented by the Attorney General. The seriousness of this imbroglio continues. The simple explanation is offense conduct violative of our federal laws. And again, the subject of dispositions in our federal courts. When we come back next week, we'll talk more about use immunity and Maxwell.
This is WISS Berlin Oshkosh and WZBU New Holstein Appleton, the Fox Valley's real news and great conversation, a civic media station.
ABC News, I'm Brian Clark. The heat index could exceed 110 degrees for millions of people today. More than 130 million in the U.S. under a blanket of dangerous heat that stretches from Texas to Maine. Flooding is a concern in the Midwest. Temperatures are much cooler in Scotland, where President Trump is playing golf at a course he owns on what the White House calls a working trip.
The president has officially landed here in Scotland to begin his four-day international trip. And the focus is going to be a mix of golf, family business, but also those ongoing trade talk. The president does have a meeting scheduled with the British prime minister in which he says they plan to fine-tune that trade deal that they reached on the sidelines of the G7 summit in Canada just a few weeks ago.